You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
If events are what decide elections, then the 2008 election was already decided when the financial meltdown began in earnest in September that year. When Barack Obama took office the following January, he was faced with the worst economic recession in almost 80 years. In a new book about that time, Noam Schreiber, a senior editor for The New Republic, lays out some of the opportunities he feels that the Obama administration has missed in dealing with the economic crisis. The Escape Artist, How Obama's Team Fumbled the Recovery, is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm pleased to welcome Noam Schreiber to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
When did you start working on this book? Did it grow out of your coverage of the presidential campaign?
It did. That's exactly right. I was covering the 2008 campaign for The New Republic, and was frankly a little burnt out on politics. And suddenly in September of 2008, this meteor hits, you know, both the political campaign and the country, this terrible financial crisis. And it suddenly becomes obvious that this is going to be the story of the next several years.
It's weird that terrible things can re-energize us.
That's right.
Many of the members of President Obama's economic team had positions in the Clinton administration. Why was that something that the transition team wanted? Shouldn't they have wanted new blood?
Yeah, it's an interesting tension that runs through the Obama story. On the one hand, he ran as this outsider and was very much an outsider. But by the same token, I always had kind of an establishment sensibility dating back to his Harvard Law School days. When the campaign began, he actually first reached out to some very establishment names. Alan Blinder, who had been a Clinton head of the Council of Economic Advisers, had been a vice chairman at the Fed, was a prominent economist at Princeton. That was the kind of person Obama actually floated that name internally, as the kind of person he wanted to advise him on economics. So he'd always had an interest in kind of establishment types. He just couldn't get them because Hillary had already kind of sucked all of them up at the beginning of the campaign.
But he didn't ask Joseph Stiglitz or Paul Krugman or some of the people that many in the public thought he might ask.
That's right. I mean, Stiglitz actually did sort of nominally advise him during the campaign, but once it got into the transition after he had won the election, he was convinced that he needed people who not just had governing experience, but experience dealing with financial crises. And there was a very short list, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you see it.
And what about dealing with Congress? Because these people had already had their own histories with Congress.
That's right. You know, I think he saw more of a bifurcation. He thought you bring in the financial crisis experts, the Larry Summers and the Tim Geithners of the world, and then you bring in the Rahm Emanuels and a guy named Phil Schlierer, who came from the House, who would be his chief legislative liaison. And so he kind of thought, I have a political team that's experienced in dealing with Congress, and I have an economic team that's experienced dealing with financial crises, and that should work out pretty well.
Well, President Obama narrowed the candidates for Treasury Secretary to Timothy Geithner, who was then the head of the New York Federal Reserve, and Lawrence Summers. Did they have very different approaches, or was it their styles that diverged?
It was a little bit of a stylistic difference. Obama very much liked the fact that Geithner was an understated guy, a self-effacing guy, didn't take up a lot of oxygen on the team. So that definitely appealed to him. They also did have slightly different approaches. I mean, I call Summers the head of the reformist Rubinite faction, referring to Bob Rubin, the former Treasury Secretary, and Tim Geithner the head of the orthodox Rubinite faction.
But Larry Summers was a rather controversial figure for lots of reasons, like things he'd said about the differences between the sexes when he was the president of Harvard. And when he was deputy secretary of the Treasury, for Clinton, didn't he testify about the deregulation of derivatives contracts before Congress, arguing that, I'm quoting, the parties to these kinds of contract are largely sophisticated financial institutions that would appear to be eminently capable of protecting themselves from fraud and counterparty insolvencies. Boy, was he wrong.
He was very wrong, yes. Larry Summers had a view of financial innovation that was very much of a piece with his view of innovation generally, that it's a very good thing and it only makes our lives better. There are some risks, definitely, but the benefits far outweigh the costs. And he viewed derivatives very much in that vein.
And in 1999, he endorsed the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which removed the separation between investment and commercial banks, saying, with this bill, the American financial system takes a major step forward towards the 21st century. Did Timothy Geithner carry as much baggage?
Geithner did not carry as much public baggage, but Timothy Geithner was effectively the regulator of the biggest banks in the country. And some of those banks, like Citigroup being the most famous, melted down during the crisis. So that, you could argue, was a pretty big piece of baggage to bring to the table in the late fall of 2008.
Had there been consistent fault lines on the economic team? As I understand it, usually it's Geithner and Peter Orszag pushing for long-term deficit reduction and Christina Romer and Larry Summers pushing for more stimulus.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. I mean, initially... There was a bit of a tactical debate between Romer and Summers. Romer just thought you should tell the president he needs a very large amount and say it straight and plain. Summers thought you should kind of factor in political considerations. What would fly in Congress? What the president's own political aides would consider a reasonable proposal? So at the very beginning, Summers actually shaded the number down, and he and Romer had a disagreement over this, over what you should actually present to the president. But as the administration goes on, you're absolutely right. Romer and Summers both realized that the initial stimulus was too small, that the unemployment rate continues to rise at a pretty rapid rate, and that their job is not done. They need to do more. And it's Geithner and really Orszag in particular who think the emphasis should be on deficit reduction. Even though they're not in principle opposed to more stimulus, the priority they think is deficit reduction.
Well, you talked about shaving the stimulus down. It started at $1.8 trillion. That's what Christina Romer said would have been necessary for it to be effective. And it wound up with $800 billion. So there was $1 trillion lost in that adjustment. That's a lot of shaving.
That's a lot of shaving. It's more of a hacking, I guess, than a shaving. In fairness to them, Romer did write in the memo that $1.7 to $1.8 trillion would be what you needed to reduce the unemployment rate to a healthy place by early 2011. Even Christy Romer, though, realized you're probably not going to get $1.7 to $1.8 trillion. She just felt
Congress.
Through Congress, exactly. She just felt like the president should be aware of what the ideal is so that he understood the trade-offs and where he fell along that spectrum.
Well, did they underestimate the severity of the crisis, or was it simply that they felt that it would be impossible to get any more than $800 billion?
It was actually both. So they both underestimated the severity of the crisis, as everyone did. They were not unique in that regard. But even with that underestimation, Romer could see that $1.7 to $1.8 trillion would be necessary. Now, it turned out much more was necessary even than that. But that was her view based on this underestimation of the hole in the economy.
My guest is Noam Scheiber, S-C-H-E-I-B-E-R. His book, The Escape Artist, How Obama's Team Fumbled the Recovery. Didn't the sequence of events work against President Obama in the early days of the administration? For instance, unemployment spiked after he took office and after the stimulus, making it look like that was the result of his policies.
Absolutely.
And he's still being blamed, even though unemployment has been going down since.
That's absolutely right. You know, a lot of political observers analogize the Obama situation to the Franklin Roosevelt situation in the early 1930s. But Roosevelt, you know, it feels strange to say it, but had many advantages over Barack Obama. And one was that the economy had plainly bottomed out by the time Roosevelt took over.
And he felt he had a real mandate.
And he had a real mandate because of the failed policies of his predecessor in dealing with the Depression. In Obama's case, you're absolutely right. The public just didn't realize how serious the problem was when he took over. So he had to act before the public understood the severity and understood that the size of the response that would be necessary to deal with it.
What about his the importance he placed on reforming health care? Was that a matter of misplaced priorities? Because he invested so much in that, then anything else that he asked for became almost impossible to get.
I think so, yeah. The health care episode really did displace a lot of other priorities, I think. It was partly the reason, actually, that he turned to Tim Geithner and Larry Summers in the first place. He thought that there were a lot of other big, important goals that he wanted to accomplish, and there was no way he could accomplish them if he didn't have the absolute best talent working on this economic situation. So it really shaped the administration from the very beginning, not just on healthcare, but across the board. And then, later on, as we move further in 2009 and it becomes evident that more stimulus is going to be necessary, healthcare really just sucks all the oxygen out of the political system, out of the administration.
Had he imagined that it would pass through Congress quickly?
That's right. The theory was what they called the quick strike, that by July of 2009, they'd really have this wrapped up. And that back in September, the Congress would come back and the president would come back from vacation, and then they could turn to more stimulus if they needed. This was Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, had drawn up this master plan, and that was the master plan.
I wonder what his plans are for Chicago now. Healthcare reform wasn't passed until March of 2010. Do you think the White House could have pushed for another round of stimulus at that point?
I think they could have, if not for a real dysfunction within the economic team. So this tension that we alluded to earlier between Orszag and Geithner on the one hand and Summers and Romer on the other, it just did not get resolved.
Were they fighting each other?
They were fighting constantly. They would have these endless discussions where Orszag and Geithner, but Orszag more explicitly, would say, you know, deficit reduction is really the top priority here. And Summers and Romer would say the economy is really hurting still. We need to reinforce this recovery.
Did they have a stimulus plan that was ready to go?
They did not. They just never got that far. The president actually, I think, would have been open to it. But anytime they presented something to him, it was always just this kind of mealy-mouthed, papered over compromise with a too small stimulus component and a too small deficit reduction component. He would immediately poke holes in it. And as soon as he did that, they would start bickering at one another again, and the whole thing would collapse again. And this continued literally for months in kind of fall of 2009 and early 2010.
Well, this is just as the campaign for the midterm elections was heating up. Could they have found the votes in the Senate to have gotten it much through?
I think they could have.
The economic numbers around that time were really terrible.
Yeah. In the very beginning of 2010, it starts to look like we're in better shape, that we're recovering. And then by kind of April, May, the air goes out of the bag a little bit, actually very abruptly. And so I think the country and certainly the political class becomes very concerned. You know, they had 59 votes in the Senate. We shouldn't forget that. So I think they had some real advantages that they don't have today. I think had Obama had a plan ready to go and had been as committed as he was with this more recent plan in the last 6 months to kind of take barnstorming the country and trying to drum up support for it, I think they could have passed something significant.
Well, the feeling was that if they had 60 votes in the Senate, it would have been different. But there were a few Democrats who didn't always go along with the administration.
That's right. It's important not to get too caught up in the exact number, because once you got up above 55, there were the Ben Nelsons and the Tim Johnsons and the Mark Warners who got queasy about passing another ambitious jobs package. But that's where I think the president kind of taking his case to the country was really important. I mean, we saw recently with this payroll tax cut extension that Obama succeeded in passing. I mean, he got a lot of Republicans to vote for that. So there was definitely room for pressure that the president could exert on the Congress by going to the public.
Well, people were complaining at the time that the president wasn't using his oratorical skills the way he had during the campaign. Why do you think he waited so long?
I think the president himself and the White House more broadly had this view that there's kind of a separation between governing and politicking. When you're on a campaign, you have to do some sort of tawdry things. You have to go before the people and pick up symbolic issues that really captivate their imagination. But the president, I think, felt that you should stop doing that once you're governing. You should be a little more straightforward. Just try to negotiate with the other side in good faith. And I think that was a real mistake.
Did he not believe Mitch McConnell when he said, our goal here is simply to deny Obama a second term? Did the Obama administration understand how little the congressional Republicans were interested in compromise when they took office?
They did not understand that. Yeah. If you talk to White House officials who remember that period well, they thought that the thing that they had a mandate for most was bipartisanship. They thought Obama had won this resounding 53% victory, and if nothing else, he had a mandate to transcend these partisan divides that had so riddled Washington before.
And we just saw in the Michigan primaries that the bailout of General Motors and Chrysler is still an issue. Republican candidates still think it was a bad idea, despite the fact that it has been more successful in the long run than the bailout of the banks and other financial institutions.
Yeah, you know, there was a real almost a double standard when it came to the autos versus Wall Street. I think everyone was prepared to be very good stewards of taxpayer money when it came to negotiating with automakers and their creditors in particular. Creditors took losses, called haircuts, and a lot of contracts were just tossed out and torn up. And I think that was ultimately very successful. It led to a very successful restructuring. When it came to Wall Street, people were much queasier about foisting losses onto bondholders, onto creditors. And as a result, I think politically, it was extremely problematic because the public just saw hundreds of billions, in fact, trillions of dollars when you add up the money that they got from the Fed and the U.S. Treasury. And they saw very few concessions that were offered in return on the part of the bank. So I think politically, the contrast between the way those two bailouts worked was very problematic for the administration.
I'm talking with Noam Scheiber about his book, The Escape Artists, How Obama's Team Fumbled the Recovery. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You write that Timothy Geithner's problem was absolutism. How did that manifest itself?
You know, Geithner believed that if you do anything that slightly calls into doubt your commitment to saving banks, whether it's asking the bondholders to take some losses or even possibly firing a CEO, anything that suggests that you're going to equivocate in your commitment to saving them, the whole system could go under. And so he was absolutely insistent upon overcompensating. In fact, he told his own aides when they would propose ideas for forcing the bondholders to take on a little more pain, he said, you know, after Lehman Brothers, I looked into an abyss and I saw that things could get very, very dark. And I'm absolutely unprepared to do that again. We will overwhelm whenever we have a choice about how much force to use.
So he felt that helping the banks would alleviate many of the other problems with the economy. That hasn't proved to be true. So what is he saying now?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Geithner had a theory, which is you certainly need a stimulus to stop the economy from getting a lot worse when it's in a recession. But it's ultimately the credit system that is going to revive the economy. If you can get banks lending to individuals and banks lending to businesses and businesses able to tap the capital markets, that will ultimately provide the stimulus you need. It did not quite work out that way. And I think the thing he missed was, yes, it's fine, it's all well and good to get credit flowing, but if there's no demand, if a company can borrow but its customers can't afford to buy anything, then you're really nowhere when it comes to an economic recovery.
Was he pretty much parroting his old boss, Robert Rubin? You say that he even imitates some of his mannerisms.
He did, yes. Rubin and Geithner both shared this incredible sort of self-deprecation. They would always begin sentences when they were in meetings, you know, I know very little about this, or I'm actually pretty bad at math, but here's my sense, you know, and it would be this pretty well thought through, pretty well constructed paragraph long riff on whatever the problem was. So they shared, you're absolutely right, they shared mannerisms, they shared manners of speaking, and they shared a worldview on some level.
And that's totally opposite to the way Larry Summers presents himself. How did he come to function as a gatekeeper for the president when it comes to the economy?
Well, the theory behind having both Larry Summers and Tim Geithner together was that you would have this sort of economic war cabinet. In kind of traditional times, when you're not facing a crisis, the Treasury Secretary is really a first among equal. But the pitch that was made to Summers was, this is going to be a war cabinet, and you will basically be on equal footing. In fact, Summers asked Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, to give him every prerogative that the national security advisor in the White House enjoyed in the security sphere. That meant every economic policy decision of any import would flow through him and his office ultimately. And he got that assurance from Rahm Emanuel in the transition, you know, as a condition of taking the job.
You criticized Summers for being unable to come up with a workable long-range plan for the president. What was he doing instead? Was this all like bandage on top of bandage?
No, I think there was a little of that. There was a little of just being too ad hoc. But I think Summers also would get very into sort of academic questions. You know, at one point in January of 2009, in the height of the crisis, he got very into accounting and kind of the esoterica of bank accounting. And he wanted to debate this endlessly with all sorts of economic advisors. And it got so frustrating that...
Well, this has to slow down the decision-making process,
It very much slowed down the process. I think Geithner himself made a decision that he could not sit in on these meetings because he actually had a financial system to fix. So Geithner would dispatch a deputy named Lee Sachs, who would go in there. And basically, Larry Summers held Lee Sachs accountable for every sin in the accounting system that banks would use. And Sachs, you know, the poor guy was also knee deep in these losses that the banks were drowning in, and really didn't have time to debate this either. But Summers would just pummel him. Summers would send aides off to go research, you know, the quirks of bank accounting, and then he would hurl them at Lee Sachs. And then on top of which, he had this very annoying habit of sort of narrating their debates as they were going on. So he'd say, "Lee, you're losing this debate. You're getting killed in this debate." it was interesting as an academic proposition, but not a model of efficiency when it came to policymaking.
And then we come back to Christina Romer, who has since left as the head of the Council of Economic Advisers. She was one of the few top advisors who hadn't been in government before. Did that put her at a disadvantage because she wasn't one of the old boys?
I think it did. And she certainly felt this very acutely. I spoke with her at length for the book. And one of the things that came through both explicitly and implicitly in our conversations was, you know, this anxiety about not just how to come up with the right answer about what would fix the economy, but how to do it in such a way that she would be accepted by this group of guys, and they were almost all guys, who had worked together throughout the 90s.
And Larry Summers was famous for his thoughts about women.
Yeah.
And their ability to handle numbers.
He was. Though, in fairness, he very much respected Christina Romer. I don't think there was any lack of respect for her intellectually. It was really a disrespect for her tactical savvy. He thought she was just naive, basically, about how government and how Congress were.
Are some of the problems that the White House has had with handling the economic crisis because the political team that President Obama put into place underestimated the importance of taking care of the economy?
I think they did. I think they absolutely did. I mean, they certainly were aware that the unemployment rate is a key factor in determining the president's political fate. There's no question about that. But I think they did not realize how long this could last. I think they thought 4 years is a long time for a presidential term. Surely, in 2 or 3 years, this thing is going to subside and will be absolutely fine. And I think they made a couple of miscalculations. One is that it could just last for a very long time. We had unemployment between roughly 9% and 10% for 2.5 years, which is a very long time, unprecedented length of time. The second thing is, though, even if it fixed itself sooner in time to help assure his reelection, it could create a lot of havoc along the way. And one of the problems it created, obviously, was they lost the House by a very large margin in 2010, which effectively froze the administration's agenda from there on out. So even if it got better in time to help the president's reelection, it basically could ensure that all of his priorities after 2010 would be thwarted.
Was the financial reform bill, better known as the Dodd-Frank Act, another missed opportunity for the White House? It turned out to be a lot weaker than most of the critics had wanted it to be.
I think it was. There's very little, if you look at the bill, there's very little actual structural reform, which is to kind of rip open the guts of these large financial institutions and put them back together in a way that makes them less dangerous for the economy. And the few pieces of structural reform were actually sort of foisted on them from without by the likes of Paul Volcker, you don't detect much of an appetite for this within the administration, and certainly within Treasury in particular. And I do think it's a real opportunity missed. You know, I think it also partially just stems from a worldview that Tim Geithner had. I interviewed him at one point in 2011, and I had previously assumed that he would have done more, but the political constraints were just too binding. That, you know, if he had his druthers, he would have ripped the guts out and tried to reconstitute them in a different way. And he told me something very revealing, which was, no, he wouldn't want to shrink the financial center. He thinks it's kind of a key to American global competitiveness, the same way that Silicon Valley is or manufacturing might be. And that was very eye-opening to me because, as I said previously, I'd assumed that we kind of agreed in principle. We just disagreed about what was politically possible. And he was telling me, no, as a matter of fact, I completely disagree with you in principle.
Wall Street started to recover more quickly than the rest of the economy. And the White House didn't seem to manage the backlash of public opinion particularly well because Geithner believed that?
That's right. I think that's part of it. And in fact, there was this...
That's what led to Occupy Wall Street.
No, absolutely. I think this goes back to the earliest days of the administration. You know, Rahm Emanuel, the chief of staff, is often derided as kind of too far to the right, and a creature of Wall Street himself. He worked as an investment banker for a number of years before running for office for the House and then joining the administration. But Rahm Emanuel actually had his finger on the pulse, and his message to Geithner within a few weeks of the administration beginning was, we have to reform Wall Street now. We have just shoveled hundreds of billions, if not trillions of dollars, into the banking system. We cannot do that unless the American people know that it's not going to happen again. And the only way to ensure and convince them that it's not going to happen again is to do some robust reform at the outset. And Geithner pushed back. He told Emanuel and the president, you know, a crisis is really the worst time to try to reform the system because you're trying to save it, and that's the first priority. And if you get distracted by trying to reform it, you're really going to risk the whole thing coming apart.
Didn't Geithner just ignore what the president wanted in relation to the solution to Citicorp's problems?
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think there was a lot of delegation. The president is a delegator. He does not micromanage. And I think there was a decision made to allow Treasury and the economic team to kind of work their way through these things. It was certainly a possibility that if the first pass at the problem didn't work, they might go back and do something a little more aggressive with Citi. But I actually do think that the president ultimately sort of left it to Geithner to make that final decision.
Do you think they've learned their lesson to some degree? The debate about extending the payroll tax cut showed just how hard an issue it is for Republicans to oppose, but they might have put up a bigger fight a year before.
No, I do think that the payroll tax fight in the last 6 months was very instructive. I think
it's unemployment insurance as well.
Unemployment insurance as well, absolutely. They caught a number of goodies that for the economy. I say that in a not a derisive way. Important measures passed through Congress. Look, it's always going to be a struggle. But if you sort of passively accept the political constraint, you're never going to do anything. No less a political savant than Tim Geithner actually told me this. The name of the game is relaxing the political constraints. And obviously you can't relax all of them at once. But if you pick your battles, you can certainly relax some of them. And I think they had a real opportunity in the spring of 2010, when the economy weakened again, to put together a big package like the one he eventually put together a year and a half later, and really just put pressure, light a fire underneath Republicans, and try to get this thing done in time to help the economy when unemployment was near 10%.
President Obama has said that he won't be reelected if the economy doesn't improve, and there are signs that it has improved. The Dow closed above 13,000 recently, and January's job report included over 240,000 new jobs. So he's going to have to convince American workers that things are better, American voters. But there's always a possibility that there'll be a little fallback.
That's right. I mean, we went through this in 2010. There was kind of a false dawn, and then the economy retreated in April and May. And then we went through it again in 2011, where we sort of felt like, and certainly the administration felt like, the economy was finally on the rebound, the recovery was being consolidated. And then, of course, within a couple of months, we were flirting with recession again. So this certainly could be a false dawn. The signs look a little more promising this time. But again, I mean, we had a month in 2010 where we had 400,000 jobs that we added. So the signs are encouraging, but it's very difficult in the moment that things are happening to really assess how lasting the recovery is going to be.
Is there a certain irony in the fact that Barack Obama was elected in 2008 in part because of the way he responded to the beginning of the economic crisis? And events might also define the 2012 election, but not necessarily in his favor.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, there's no question that, if you talk to the Obama political people, they absolutely feel like Obama won the presidency in the 2 weeks that followed the collapse of Lehman Brothers. McCain looked completely overwhelmed by what was happening and completely out of touch with the situation as it was unfolding. Obama looked cool. He looked in control. He had command of details. So it's absolutely the case that, or certainly they're convinced that won them the election. There's clearly an irony given that the guy had run on healthcare reform, on cap and trade, on solving these generational problems that he felt that the political system just hadn't responded to.
And now he is being tarred and feathered with all of those
things. And that's exactly right. And now, you could argue maybe it was unfair from a Republican's perspective that this thing fell in his lap and helped him win the election. Well, now this crisis that he inherited has weighed him down for the last 3 years. So what goes around comes around in politics, I guess.
Noam Scheiber is a senior editor at the New Republic magazine. He has written a book called The Escape Artists, How Obama's Team Fumbled the Recovery. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us today.
I really enjoyed it.